That was Armando Sanchez and his septet, and this is Fresh Air on WHYY FM in Philadelphia. It's 4 minutes after 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to 91 FM. I want to remind you that this Saturday night at 9 o'clock, there will be a live jazz concert in our studios with Bob Perkins. That's tomorrow night, and performing will be Michael Hill and friends. You're invited to come. We ask you first to just call and reserve a seat. Our number is 351-9200. That's 351-9200. Just tell us how many people we'll be coming with you, and we'll make those reservations. That's for tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, a concert with Michael Hill and friends, hosted by Bob Perkins. The number again, 351-9200. With me now on Fresh Air is John D'Amelio, who's the author of the new book, Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. It's a historical analysis of the creation of gay activism from 1940 to 1970. He writes about how World War II helped create a gay community, the politics and organizing style of the early homophile groups like the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis, and the impact of the civil rights movement, student activism, and feminism on gays. John D'Amelio is an assistant professor of American history at the University of North Carolina. He's the editor of the book The Civil Rights Struggle, Leaders in Profile, and The Universities and the Gay Experience. His new book, Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities, is published by the University of Chicago Press. John D'Amelio will be speaking tonight at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center at 222 South Camac Street. There is an admission fee. For more information, you can call 546-9999. That number again, 546-9999. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
What kinds of questions were you trying to answer when you began the research for your new book?
Well, I had been active in the gay liberation movement in New York in the early 1970s, and at the same time I was also studying history at Columbia. And I was interested in knowing where the gay liberation movement came from, because we were in the midst of it, and it seemed to come out of nowhere very suddenly and grow very rapidly. And yet I knew, because of the studying that I was doing of history and reform movements, that movements don't grow like that. They have roots, they have foundations, and they have origins. And so I was interested in trying to find out what had happened before gay liberation began around 1969 or 1970.
There were a couple of groups who we'll talk about in more depth a little later that were more conservative gay groups. Do you think that the more radical gay organizers of the 60s and 70s looked down on or rejected their predecessor gay groups?
Well, very much so. As a matter of fact, I think, I mean, if I can recall correctly what all of us thought in the early 70s, I think we had two ways of looking at the people who came before us. I mean, first of all, we tended to define gay life in, you know, two great periods. There was before Stonewall, which was grim, and there was after Stonewall, which had promise. And the people that came before, we didn't really know them. We knew there were groups like the Mattachine and the Daughters of Bilitis. And there was a view, one, of either dismissal. You know, nothing that they did really mattered very much, because if it had been important, things wouldn't be as bad as they were now. Or going further even, to actually hold them in contempt. I mean, to see them as being extremely conservative, very closeted, very fearful, not at all proud of being gay, and in many ways to look at the homophile activists in the way that black radicals at the end of the 60s and the early 70s were looking at people who had been in the NAACP in the 1950s as Uncle Toms who really weren't where it's at. So that there was really a dismissal of the work that had come before us.
I think your book is a reevaluation of that.
Very much so. I mean, I didn't actually know this would happen as I was doing the research, but in the course of doing it, it became clear to me, and I think this is what I was trying to say more than anything else in the book, is that without the work that came before, gay liberation would not have been possible. Yes, they worked in a different time, and they did not do the kind of dramatic, visible, overtly successful things that gay liberationists were doing in the 1970s, but they did do what was possible at the time and it made a tremendous amount of difference.
You chose the years 1940 to 1970 to bracket your study. Why did you choose those years?
Well, the movement itself begins in 1950 when the Mattachine Society is founded, and initially I thought that I would look from the beginnings of the movement in that narrow sense of an organization up to Stonewall, but as I started looking at the Mattachine Society and what gay life was like at the time that it was formed, it became clear to me that I had to go further back. And the reason I stopped at 1940 is that the 1940s turn out to be a very critical decade in the lives of gay and lesbian Americans, that it was in these 10 years that a gay community in American cities really starts to grow and really begins to coalesce. And that community and those changes in gay life became the foundation out of which organizations eventually developed.
You suggest that the medical definition, the medical attribution of deviance or psychological disturbance of homosexuality made people identify themselves as gay or as straight, and that that wasn't happening before.
Right. The medical model really goes back to the late 19th century, when doctors are beginning to take over the area of sexuality from moralists, although there's a lot of moralizing in what the doctors do. And they begin to talk about different kinds of sexuality, and particularly they isolate homosexuality as a special form of deviance. But for most of the late 19th and early 20th century, the medical model just belongs to the doctors. It doesn't have very wide circulation, certainly in this country. A little bit through novels like The Well of Loneliness, which was about a lesbian and which uses the model of people being born lesbian to develop its story. But it isn't until World War II and the 1940s that suddenly the medical model gets quite a great deal of currency in this country, because psychiatrists are used during the war. They gain a new kind of influence and an ability to define what human sexuality is about. And one of the byproducts of that is that the popularization of the medical model allowed men and women who had all these sexual feelings that they might not have been able to define or understand or identify, suddenly to look at those feelings and say, oh, maybe I'm what these doctors are talking about, and to suddenly put a label onto themselves and say, this is who I am and this is the way I want to live.
Was it ultimately good or bad in organizing gay communities?
Well, it's both. I mean, obviously, until very recently, the medical model has been a negative one. It's defined homosexuality not simply in medical terms, but as a sickness or as an abnormality. And so one side of the medical approach to homosexuality is that a lot of us have internalized, especially in this earlier generation, very negative images, so that even as we came to a self-definition as gay, that self-definition was often a negative one. On the other hand, people just sort of are not passive recipients of information that's coming to them. And for quite a lot of people, it was really liberatory to be able to put a name onto who they were. And a lot of men and women had enough of a sense of self and a positive opinion of themselves and their choices that they could accept the definition of homosexual or lesbian and not accept all of the negative baggage that the medical establishment was attaching to it.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you think the 1940s is a crucial period in the beginnings of gay communities. Did that have to do with World War II?
Very much so. One of the things that the war does, one of the major things that it does in terms of disrupting everyday life, is that it took literally millions of relatively young men and relatively young women out of a family environment where heterosexual roles are normally learned and in some cases imposed. For men, it took them out of the family in small towns and put them in the sex-segregated environment of the military. Some women also went into the military, but much more often they found themselves taking jobs that they might not have taken before. And not simply taking jobs, but moving to where the jobs were, so that women are migrating to San Francisco and Los Angeles and a whole bunch of other cities, are working in all-female workplaces, living in boarding houses with other women. So what the war does is to create a lot of sex-segregated environments. And in those environments, people who were gay already were able to discover others like themselves. And people who had homosexual feelings but hadn't identified them yet or acted on them suddenly had opportunities that they would not have had in the ordinary course of their lives to act upon this. And out of it emerged networks of gay friends, a sense of freedom that people didn't have before the war, and also a determination to continue that when the war ended. One of the very specific changes in terms of gay and lesbian life that World War II in the 40s created is an explosion of gay bars in American cities. Before the war, there were some bars. They often tended to be mixed, not exclusively gay. They were often places of drag entertainment. During and after the war, the gay and lesbian bar that we're more familiar with today, places that are exclusively for gay men or for lesbians, just grow by leaps and bounds. And it created a geographic space in cities where people could be together and have a sense of themselves as a group, which many gay men and lesbians had never had before.
How does that connect to World War II? Was that responsible in some way for the creation of the bars?
Well, yes, I think in the sense that institutions developed for the social situation that was suddenly there, so that there were many gay men and lesbians sort of on the loose. They were out in the cities. They were taking their weekend leaves, or they were women who were looking for places to socialize at night. And bars that weren't gay became gay just by virtue of a certain kind of repetitive patronage of it. And in other cases, some bars opened exclusively for a gay or lesbian clientele.
Why is the bar an important focus in the gay and lesbian communities?
Well, at this point in history, I think the reason is that it was really the only public space in society that was gay. People before that had private parties. They had their individual relationships. Men were carving out cruising areas in cities, in parks, or on streets at night. But the bar was a place where you could let down your hair, where no one else was there. You were there collectively. There, unless the police raided, which they often did, there seemed to be no interference from the outside world. And it was an opportunity to be gay in a public setting as much as you could be anywhere in America at the time. And it helped to create a group identity.
John D'Amelio is my guest if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. Did McCarthyism affect gays?
Very much. It provides this interesting contrast with what we were just talking about. In some ways, the 40s was a decade of de facto liberalization. It became easier in the 40s to be gay. Then you have McCarthyism, which we normally associate with anti-radical activity, anti-communist activity, but there was also a very strong anti-gay, anti-lesbian component to McCarthyism. In 1950, there was a State Department official testified before Congress that in their security program at the State Department, they had recently fired many homosexual employees. And this suddenly became a major issue, a major political issue that conservative Republicans, including McCarthy, picked up. The Senate investigated the employment of homosexuals by the government. There were a variety of new laws passed, quite a great deal of media publicity about the homosexual menace. The military also intensified its purges of lesbians and gay men from the service so that as many as 2,000 to 3,000 men and women per year in the 50s were being discharged on grounds of homosexuality. And local police forces felt that they had the go-ahead because of what was happening in Washington to mount a much larger campaign against these new gay institutions such as the bars. So just at the point where many people were getting a stronger sense of themselves as being gay and of the possibility of living this way, suddenly the repression came down. And yes, it made life harder for gay men and women, but on the other hand, it provided a very clear sense of injustice, that gay people weren't these sort of individuals isolated, but that in fact they were the targets of discrimination and systematic mistreatment. And it made gay life more dangerous, but it also helped to increase the sense of cohesion and group solidarity.
I guess the Mattachine Society, which is one of the early groups that you mentioned in your history, was founded in about 1950?
1950. And the history of the Mattachine Society is very much connected in quite surprising ways with McCarthyism and political repression, because the Mattachine was started in Los Angeles. And the founders of the Mattachine were a group of gay men who also had either been members of the Communist Party during the 30s and 40s, or what was called at that time fellow travelers. And it was because they were both gay and also had a radical political analysis that they were able to look at the repression that was starting in America at that time and say, we need to do something. We've learned how to fight for Social Security and for unions and for migrant farm laborers in California. Now it's time to apply what we know about organizing and about our understanding of American society and American politics, to apply this to ourselves and our own lives and to other gay people. And so they made an attempt, a successful attempt, to form an organization that they called Mattachine. They created it as a secret organization modeled on the hierarchical cell structure of the Communist Party. And their strategy for organizing gays was, and building a gay movement, was to, first of all, create discussion groups where gay men and, to a lesser extent, lesbians could meet together in a safe environment and begin a process of consciousness raising. In many ways, the early Mattachine Society created the first consciousness-raising groups in the gay community. And they really believed that out of this consciousness-raising and this self-examination would come a willingness on the part of men and women to begin to take militant action against oppression. And in fact, after the discussion groups got started and became very successful, Mattachine leaders had an opportunity to fight a case of entrapment in Los Angeles when one of the founders of the Mattachine was arrested on an entrapment charge.
If they were a secret group, how could people find out about them?
Well, you could only find out by word of mouth initially in the first couple of years. In order to write this book, I interviewed a lot of people who were active in the organizations at the time. And for the people that I was able to find who were in the early Mattachine Society, they talked about the Mattachine discussion groups in the most glowing terms. It was like it turned their lives around. It was suddenly not only could they be gay, but they could be proud of being gay. Suddenly they could meet other gay men and women not purely in a sexual context. And so people who made their way into these discussion groups, initially through friendship ties with the founders, were very willing to tell all of their friends and acquaintances about it and drag them, sometimes unwillingly because people were afraid, to these discussion groups, and that's how the discussion groups grew. After they took on this entrapment case, they began circulating gay flyers throughout Los Angeles. Flyers that announced the case, that talked about police entrapment, and that also provided a mailing address where people could write for more information. And the success of that entrapment fight just created a deluge of people who wanted to become part of the organization.
Was the Mattachine Society more vulnerable to McCarthyism because of its communist roots?
Yes. I mean, it was not vulnerable as long as it remained successfully secret, but since the goal of the founders was not to remain secret forever, since they wanted to build a movement, as they became more visible, they also became more vulnerable to attack. They became vulnerable to attack from outside the organization because of the fears about communism and homosexuality, and they became vulnerable to attack from inside the organization because as the Mattachine grew very quickly after 1952, a lot of the people who came in were no longer associated with this original group of radicals and tended to be your ordinary gay American who shared all of the political views and prejudices that other Americans might have shared at the time. And the turning point for the Mattachine came early in 1953 when a columnist for one of the LA papers managed to hear about the Mattachine Society and a questionnaire that Mattachine leaders were distributing to candidates for city office in Los Angeles, asking them about entrapment and sex education in the public schools. It's kind of outrageous to think that they were actually asking about this in the middle of the McCarthy era, but they were. And he wrote a column that was sort of both a red-baiting and fag-baiting column, making the connection between this organization, which allegedly included communists and communist sympathizers, and the investigations in Washington about the threat of homosexuals to national security. And so this column hit one of the Los Angeles papers, and really, I mean, there was an uproar in the organization, especially the newer members who were mainstream Americans were suddenly very upset that Manishin was being tainted with the brush of communism. And what ended up happening is that in the effort to reorganize the Manishin as an above-ground organization, the anti-communism was so strong that the leaders, while they weren't technically purged, realized that they just had to drop out because it would destroy the organization. And so they left, and the Manishin lost its connection with these its radical dynamic roots and became, for the next several years, actually quite a conservative organization.
There was initially, as you mentioned, women in the group, lesbians in the group, who eventually, I think, split from the group and formed, well, I don't know if it was people who in Manishin split from it and formed a different group, but a separate lesbian group was formed. Why do you think at that point in time women felt that there was a need for a lesbian group with a separate identity from the largely men's group, which was the Manishin Society?
Well, a couple of things. One is that although the Manishin was open to lesbians, it started with a group of men. The nature of sort of word-of-mouth spreading is that most of the recruits tended to be men, so that the women who were in the organization were always in a minority. And in some cases, it was tokenism, and some of the groups, they were a substantial minority, but a minority nonetheless. And one of the results of that, especially in pre-feminist America, where there wasn't a great deal of awareness, explicit awareness about women's oppression and about sexism, was that men defined the issues and men sort of defined the terrain of gay politics. One example for instance, is that they took on an entrapment case as their first activity. And at that point, entrapment was an issue that, I mean, it was an injustice, but it was an issue that primarily affected gay men because it was gay men who were cruising on the streets rather than lesbians. Also, just in terms of the nature of the subculture, there were places in the subculture where gay men and lesbians overlapped and were in contact with one another and had friendship networks. But in the largest cities, they tended to be separate, that the largest cities were able to sustain bars that just served gay men or just served lesbians, so that really separate forms of gay and lesbian life were developing, and the situation of women was different. I mean, they had larger concerns about job discrimination. Many of the women of this era were also coping with problems of motherhood and how to raise children and be a lesbian at the same time. So I think it was inevitable that at some point, once gay organizing got started, a group of lesbians was going to form their own organization. And that happened in San Francisco in 1955 with the formation of the Daughters of Bilitis. Now, interestingly, it wasn't formed by women who had been in the Manishin Society. It was formed by women who were lesbians who were interested initially in forming a social club as an alternative to the bars. And as they began meeting and forming their club, one thing led to another, and they began talking about the possibility of forming an organization that would do something. They didn't call it political. They called it educational. Having public forums or public events or publishing material that would begin to re-educate America as to what lesbianism was really like. Eventually, in a relatively short time, they made contact with the Manishin Society, and then there were, for the next 20 years, there were lines of cooperation between gay male groups and lesbian groups, but organizationally they remained separate, so that DOB was always a lesbian organization, and the Manishin, although it pretended to be for men and women, in fact, was a men's organization.
Was Daughters of Bilitis a secretive organization the way the Manishin Society was when it was founded?
Not the way Manishin was when it was founded. DOB became more like the newer Manishin Society, which was an open membership organization that was public, but that also was very concerned about protecting the confidentiality of members' names so that you could be a member of the organization and be public about who you were, or you could be a member of the organization but also use a pseudonym or not appear in public. Both of the organizations in the second half of the 50s, I think you would have to describe as conservative. Now, partly they were conservative because it would have been difficult to be anything else in the 50s. It was just too dangerous to be militantly gay. Partly they were conservative because of their own internalized fears. Many of them had, at some level, even though they were taking the step of organizing, had accepted many of the traditional beliefs about being gay and being lesbian. They accepted the authority of doctors, for instance, to describe homosexuality and to define it, which got them sometimes into jams. I mean, they found themselves agreeing with doctors who were basically saying that gay people were sick.
Do you think that Mattachine and DOB had a real mobilizing effect on the gay community or made gays more visible to heterosexuals?
Well, in the 50s, I'm not sure that they succeeded in doing that. Their effect was very limited. They were really creating foundations and setting precedents. For instance, each of the organizations, the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis, and then another group called One, which was simply a publishing group, each of them published magazines during the 50s, the latter, the Mattachine Review, and One Magazine. And this was the first time that explicitly gay material was being published in periodical form. They faced censorship when they were doing it. One magazine took their case all the way up to the Supreme Court to fight postal censorship and succeeded. So that they were setting the precedent of gay publishing, and it's a precedent that we're benefiting from today. Yet they also, their success was limited. For instance, the circulation of One magazine never exceeded about 5,000 copies per month, and the latter was even much smaller than that, the lesbian magazine. It was several hundred copies a month. So these magazines were a beacon of hope. You might come across it and think, oh my God, the possibilities, even while you were still afraid to join one of the organizations. But it didn't have a major impact yet.
John D'Amelio is my guest. He's an historian who has written a new book called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. In the 60s, San Francisco started to emerge as a center for gays. What factors made San Francisco a center?
Well, there are a number of different things. I mean, San Francisco's history is really, in some ways, unique. The reason it's so much of a gay center today is because things have been happening there for a long time. One of the things that happened, of course, is that San Francisco was the major port of debarkation and embarkation for troops in the Pacific Theater during World War II. So that the things that we were talking about earlier, how the war affected gay life, many of the soldiers and sailors and WACs who were discharged from the Army at the end of the war were discharged in the Bay Area, and they settled there. So that there was an influx of gay men and lesbians from around the country into San Francisco that really begins in the 40s. Two other things that happened that really affect gay life in San Francisco, ultimately in a positive way, is that in the 50s, San Francisco, and particularly the North Beach section, was the center for the what we call the Beat Generation as a literary movement. And the Beats in the 1950s, people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, were among, in white America anyway, were among the only dissenters from the sort of conformist image of the man with the gray flannel suit and the happy housewife. And they were really arguing for a different way to live, particularly around sexuality. And so they provided a Ginsberg especially provided a very visible image of an alternative sexuality. The other thing that affected gay life in San Francisco was that the police in San Francisco, especially in the late 50s and early 60s, were particularly repressive. From about 1958 to 1962, they mounted a campaign against gay bars, which was probably unprecedented in America. And the repression was so heavy that it was impossible to accept it anymore. And so people began to fight back and to fight back in an organized way.
In the 60s encompassed the civil rights movement, student activism, the beginnings of the new wave of feminism. Do you think that that organizing, I should mention student activism too if I didn't, do you think that organizing helped create a model for gay organizing?
Slowly it did. It took a while, but it, I would say, especially in the early 60s, it's the civil rights movement more than anything else that provides a model for a younger group of gay activists who are starting to join the organizations then, who decide to break with the accommodationism and the conservatism of the leaders in the 50s. And particularly, it's they look at blacks and, one, the fact that they're using confrontational tactics, that they're not relying on education and persuasion anymore, but that people are marching in the streets, they're doing boycotts, picket lines, and things like that. And secondly, that in terms of consciousness, the black movement was turning around, upside down, the dominant images about black people. They, you know, black is beautiful, taking pride in a heritage that before that white Americans had despised and put down, and turning it around and being proud of who they were. And some gay activists, particularly on the East Coast, took that model wholesale. I mean, they just, you know, took it and said, let us imitate. Let us do what blacks are doing. Let us, one, reject what the medical establishment is saying about us, and let's stop being closeted. If we don't get out there in the streets and publicly affirm our homosexuality in some way and take on oppressive institutions, nothing will ever change. And so picket lines, for instance, in Washington, D.C., began to form in 1965 and 1966 against the Civil Service Commission and the Pentagon and the State Department. They were the first gay demonstrations.
You mentioned Stonewall before as being a real turning point for gays, and that especially in the 70s, gays saw American life as being pre or post Stonewall. Do you want to explain what happened at that bar and its effects on the gay community?
Sure. The Stonewall riot occurred in New York City on the last weekend in June of 1969. The Stonewall Inn was a bar on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village, and it was not what you would call a respectable gay bar. Now, in some ways, that's a contradiction in terms because no gay bar was respectable then. But it was a bar that, one, it was mafia-controlled. It was operating without a liquor license. It had go-go boys dancing in G-strings, which was very risque in 1969. And it tended to cater to a young crowd that was underage, a crowd that was heavily third world, and that also included quite a number of transvestites. And in other words, in some ways, people with the least to lose, who were most outside of the mainstream of American life. 1969 was also an election year in New York City. And although the Mattachine Society in New York had succeeded in the previous 3 or 4 years in bringing almost an end to raids of gay bars by the New York City police so that gay life was starting to grow in New York, because it was an election year, election years always made gays vulnerable. And so the police decided to raid the Stonewall Inn, thinking that it was an easy target because it was mafia controlled and didn't have a liquor license. They raided the bar, and instead of people meekly going away in vans to night court, the patrons rioted in the streets. They trapped the police in the bar. They set fire to the bar. The Tactical Patrol Force had to rescue these police officers from being burned alive. And then for the next 3 nights, hundreds, if not thousands, of drag queens and young gay street people were rioting in Greenwich Village, battling the Tactical Patrol Force. The image of queens rioting so contradicted the stereotype of the male homosexual that it just had this explosive effect on the gay community, not only in New York, but because of the radicalism of the 60s and the networks of communication that had been created upon gay men and lesbians throughout the United States. And Stonewall really marks a divide between the earlier homophile movement, which was becoming more militant but was still fairly limited and traditional in its politics, and then a radical movement that was confrontational and outrageous and talked about revolution rather than reform.
What groups emerged from that Stonewall riot?
Well, a number of groups that went under the name of Gay Liberation Front, that specifically, the name even, kind of drew its inspiration from the Vietnam War and the National Liberation Front. Also, equivalent, although many of the early GLF groups were included men and women. Very quickly, separate radical groups of lesbians began to form, so that there was radical lesbians formed in New York City, the Furies formed in Washington, D.C., and gay women's liberation in San Francisco. So it was just a whole outpouring of activity.
The left at that time was sharing demands with each other. There are a lot of different groups representing special interests and forming coalitions as well. And the coalitions would, when making demands, usually pool the demands of the different special interest groups. Do you think that the left started to add on gay issues because of the formation of the Gay Liberation Front?
Yes and no. I mean, there was obviously once there were the fact that gay liberation was a radical movement and included in its early days many men and women who, you know, under straight cover had been active in the New Left anyway, so that they had been members of SDS or members of this or members of that, gave the radical gay liberationists entry into New Left coalitions and New Left organizations. Now, in some cases, the straight left was simply not prepared to deal with it, and there was a good deal of homophobia and a dismissal of the issue as not being significant or important. And yet in other cases, I mean, clearly a process of sort of education was underway, and that as with feminism and as with other issues, once the issue is raised, some people are prepared to begin moving on it. Now, it's interesting that one of the major sources for movement in sort of favor of gay liberation that was coming out of the larger movement actually came from the Black Panther Party, even though I think traditionally the Black, sort of our memory of them is as being maybe very macho or very straight or something like that. On the other hand, people like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, for whatever reason, I don't know, were very receptive to adding on gay liberation demands to these sort of general movement platforms so that gays were invited to the conventions and the conferences that the Panthers were beginning to convene in 1970 and 71 for all radicals. So there was a combination of movement and resistance.
Wouldn't you say, too, that the feminist movement provided an impetus for challenging all sexual stereotyping?
Well, the feminist movement, I think, was the most important source of gay liberation ideology because it provided, well, one, a critique of gender roles, of saying that, you know, there's gender roles are oppressive and men don't have to be men in the way that we thought and women don't have to be women in the way that we thought. And one aspect of that was sexuality, you know, that it was possible for members of the same sex to love each other and have sex together and that this represented a break with sexist value structures. Certainly it was obviously important for lesbians, but it was also, even if that influence isn't acknowledged anymore, it was very important for gay men, radical gay men, in the early 70s.
John D'Amelio is my guest, and he's written a new book called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities, The Making of a Homosexual Minority in the United States from 1940 through 1970. Your book ends in 1970, but I'd like to take things past that.
Okay.
One of the issues when gay liberation became part of the platform of other left groups was whether, with the inclusion of that, you'd be alienating more of mainstream America, who the left was trying to reach at that time. And this was happening in the women's movement, too, in such organizations as NOW, which was really looking for a mainstream base as well as a more radical base. Do you think that that kind of debate is still happening?
It is still happening. It tends, I think, to be strongest in the leftist organizations that are sectarian organizations, that are very explicitly Marxist-identified and sort of identify the sort of prime target of radical energy as being the industrial working class. By and large, I mean, there are exceptions to this. By and large, they tend to be the ones who are most resistant to gay demands or gay liberation as an important organizing issue. I find that ironic because it's not as if the industrial working class is any more receptive to the left, you know, spontaneously than it is to gay liberation, and it requires for many American workers such a leap to identify with either socialism or communism that if people can make that leap, I think they could easily, in fact, make the leap to understanding that gay liberation is an issue of social justice. In terms of the sort of looser left, the broader left, from organizations like Democratic Socialists of America to a lot of the New Peace Movement, there is, I think, a much greater receptivity to gay issues, but there's also still a great deal of confusion. People haven't dealt with their own sexual fears sufficiently.
Where do you think America is now in terms of how it officially regards homosexuality and lesbianism? And I'm thinking of the military, the medical profession, the religious community, city governments.
Mm-hmm. I think that in the last 15 years, there has been a tremendous opening up, that the movement has created safe spaces that didn't exist before. Partly because police harassment is not as great, although it still exists. Partly because there has just been an opening up of debate in the media, in schools, and so there's more information available. And partly because of really nitty-gritty organizing in churches, in the medical establishment, and in government. There's been this opening up and room to maneuver, but I don't think that you can say that there's been, at this point, any kind of fundamental structural change in the way our institutions operate, so that there is still gay discrimination against gay men and lesbians almost everywhere. In some places, like the military, it's more severe than others. But I also think that if we look, for instance, at the black movement, I mean, in some ways, this is where the black movement was a generation ago. Before there was national civil rights legislation, there was civil rights legislation on a municipal and a state level, and that's what gay men and lesbians are doing now. At the same time that they're trying to preserve and create a community that gives us the room to maneuver and the room to live safely.
You cited 1955 when Daughters of Bilitis was founded as the time when lesbians started to form their own movement separate from gay men. Do you see this as a time for separate gay and lesbian movements or a time of coalitions?
Well, more in the direction of coalition, but I think that as long as gay and lesbian liberation is still an issue that's being fought, there will always be organizations that are primarily male organizations and organizations that are lesbian organizations, that's a good thing. What I think is important, and this represents a change from the sort of passions of the early 70s, is that you're much more likely to find gay men and lesbians working in the same organizations or their separate organizations cooperating together. And I think that's absolutely necessary now, that there's enough consciousness has been raised and enough separate space has been created that we can now afford to work together and need to work together.
For young people who are coming out now, they're coming out in a period when it's not that dangerous to come out. People are still at risk of losing their jobs in many places and at risk of great discrimination, but it's certainly nothing like it was during the McCarthy period or even in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see happening amongst gay people coming out now, the younger people who have the benefit of the radical movements that have gained more acceptance for homosexuality?
A couple of different things which are a little bit contradictory. On the one hand, I think that because of the visibility that the movement has created for gay men and lesbians, that gay teenagers today, or teenagers who are becoming gay, have much greater access to information and are much more easily able to develop a sense of themselves as gay and know what the resources are that are available to them, whether it be hanging out outside gay bars or knowing where there's a gay youth group or a gay counseling center. And that's a real good thing. It just makes that transition much easier. There are fewer years of isolation. On the other hand, one of the losses in the course of the 70s is that the visibility of homosexuality has become less political. In the early 70s, if you saw gay or you saw lesbian, you were seeing people who were political radicals. Today, when you see it, you much more tend to see the image of the disco or the sort of middle-class professional gay man who's leading this wild lifestyle. And the political identity that existed isn't so easy to sort of develop today. There aren't dynamic organizations, as many of them, that young gays can plug into. And instead, they're coming out into a world that's easier to be gay in, but that in many ways is also very alienating and very isolating. And so there's, they know they're gay sooner, but they don't necessarily plug into something that's going to be satisfying to them.
If your generation looked at the early homophile groups and thought that they were really too conservative to really be reckoned with, do you think that younger gays now are looking at the radicals and dismissing them and saying, oh, what was all the fuss about anyways?
Well, actually, in some ways, I wish they would dismiss us, because that would mean they'd have a better, they'd at least know that it existed. And there's something about America that we have a very poor sense of history. I mean, part of the motive for writing this book is to was for me to provide people with a sense of what happened before 1970. Well, also, what happened in the early 70s is history now, and a lot of people are simply unaware of it. I mean, they have no memory of people chaining themselves to City Hall to get, you know, the mayor to listen or things like that. And I'd be happy if they dismissed us, if they knew that this they had this tradition, because then they could make a choice of either valuing it or not valuing it. In many cases, I think they just take for granted that the way gay life is now is the way that it's always been, and don't realize that it's been created because of the hard fights that many people waged.
John D'Amelio is my guest, a historian who's written a new book called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. Because most of the people who initially got AIDS in America were gay men, do you think that the view of gays is being affected by that?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, I think that because this is not yet a society that accepts gays as equals. Whenever something like this happens, it's very easy to start scapegoating a group of people, so that there is an incredible amount of, despite the medical knowledge that we do have, that AIDS is not communicated by casual contact, that you can't catch it by sitting next to somebody on a bus. A lot of people are absolutely terrified, and heterosexuals, and some of them are beginning to look at the gay community as a public health threat. I mean, the main threat is to ourselves right now rather than to sort of the rest of society. Counterbalancing that, I think the reality is that the growth and the strength of the gay community that's developed in the last 10 or 15 years puts us in a position to be able to fight that relatively effectively. And one of the most impressive things about the AIDS crisis is that, the tragedy notwithstanding, the gay community, especially in larger cities, has organized very quickly and very effectively to do something about it, both to help the people who have the disease, but also to make sure that government begins to respond and, I mean, a whole range of things sort of to counteract the possible negative reaction that can occur.
Probably the most vocal opponent of homosexuality during the past few years has been the moral majority in groups like it, ultra-conservative groups, fundamentalist groups. How has that, what impact do you think that's had?
Well, in some places it's obviously had a negative impact. I mean, first of all, a number of gay rights ordinances were repealed, but also in parts of the country, particularly I'm thinking of the South and parts of the Southwest, where Christian fundamentalism is stronger, there have been successful anti-gay initiatives, so that I'm pretty sure both in Arkansas and Oklahoma, for instance, there are anti-gay teacher laws. On the other hand, it's galvanized the gay community and upped the level of organization, and I think that's good.
You've immersed yourself in recent gay history to write your book. What are some of the other conclusions that you've drawn?
Well, one is that gay identity changes over time. It isn't this constant. 100 years ago, people in America who had homosexual desire didn't think of themselves as being different or as being gay. A gay community has been created because of large social and economic changes. A gay political movement has grown out of that community. One of the things in terms of looking into the future is to leave, my impulse is to leave open the possibility that being gay 20 years from now may be as different from what gay life is today as it was 50 years ago, and that we don't know. I mean, the categories may start to dissolve. There may be a much greater, if we're successful, a much greater fluidity in terms of people's sexual self-definition.
You mentioned before that one of the things you want to do is help gays have a sense of their own past. And also, I think for heterosexuals too, it's a part of pretty unknown history. Your book is published on a university press, which is usually not given window displays in bookstores. What kinds of methods do you see for telling recent history to people that you think is important?
Well, I mean, one of the most obvious ways is to do it through the schools. I mean, that's where history is ordinarily told, but it's also true that, especially within the gay community, one of the things that's happening is that a lot of people who aren't connected with the university are doing historical research and creating community-based history projects that, through slideshows and lectures and pamphlets and other kinds of events, are making history a living part of the community. And that's not just happening among gays. I mean, one of the most dynamic aspects of the women's movement has also been a recovering and an uncovering of women's history. And this has also been true in the black community, the development of both archives and local history projects and things like that. And I think it's very important that we keep doing this kind of grassroots work so that people have a stronger sense of where they've come from and who they are.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. You've done some really interesting research. Thanks for sharing it.
Okay.
John D'Amelio has been my guest, and he's written a new book called Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. I'll spell his last name for you. It's D'Emilio, John D'Amelio, the book again, Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities. He'll be speaking tonight at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center in Philadelphia at 222 South Camac Street. And for more information, you can call 546-9999. That's 546-9999, and there is an admission fee. That's at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center at 222 South Camac Street. It's 4 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening Monday afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Amtrak between Philadelphia and New York, both directions. 20-minute delays can be expected due to an accident involving two trains that occurred shortly before 2 o'clock this afternoon outside New York. Also, New Jersey Transit trains, you can expect up to 45-minute delays between Newark and New York. Now, if you're heading home from work in Philadelphia, Schuylkill Expressway slow from east of Montgomery through south, an earlier disabled vehicle. Westbound, some heavy volume from approaching Strawberry Mansion to west of City Line Avenue, and again for a mile approaching 202. And a very heavy volume on the Roosevelt Extension from the Twin Bridges up through the Wissahickon Avenue off-ramp and again through the detour. And if you're traveling across the Wall-Whitman Bridge, eastbound slow from approaching the tolls down to Route 42 at 295 due to police activity off to the side. And that's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That shadow traffic report was funded with a grant from Penn Jersey Auto Stores. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, I'll be speaking with French cuisine expert Barbara Wheaton, author of a book called Savoring the Past, The French Kitchen and Table from 1300 to 1789. At 3:40, our arts reporter Julie Burstein will report on a new ceramics show currently in town. And at 4 o'clock, we'll feature a radio drama called Reflections of a Rock Lobster, which is based on the case of Aaron Frick, who won in court the right to take his male lover to his Rhode Island High School senior prom. So that's all coming up Monday afternoon on Fresh Air. This Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on The Best of Fresh Air, we'll be hearing from two people who started experimenting with psychedelic drugs in the 60s and continue to do that today. We'll be hearing with one of the most publicized advocates of psychedelic drugs, Timothy Leary, and also from Andrew Weil, who has written a book called Chocolate to Morphine about mind-altering drugs. That's this Sunday at 2 o'clock on The Best of Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. Jay Goldman was the technical director today. Elizabeth Perez Luna contributed. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller, the co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good weekend. Thank you. is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm David Maupas.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.